Triple Devil. It was not surprising that at this particular banquet of the Black Widowers, the conversation turned on the subject of self-made men. After all, Mario Gonzalo, host of the evening, was bringing as his guest the well-known retired owner of a chain of bookstores, Benjamin Manfred. It was also well known that Manfred had delivered newspapers as a young lad more than half a century before, and was the son of poor but honest parents, very honest and very, very poor. And now here he was, not exactly a Getty or an Onassis, but very comfortably situated, and with four children and a number of grandchildren, all engaged in dealing with one portion or another of the chain. He was even the founder of a dynasty. Since Manfred had phoned to say, with many regrets, that he would be a little delayed, but would certainly be there before the actual banquet was begun, it meant that the cocktail hour was taking place in his absence, and the conversation could continue freely without the inhibition produced by the very presence of one of those who was the subject of discussion. Nor was it surprising that the loudest of the pontificators was Emmanuel Rubin. "There is no such thing as a self-made man, or woman for that matter, any more," said Rubin, with passion, and when he spoke with passion there was no choice but to listen. If his 64 inches made him the shortest of the Black Widowers, his voice was undoubtedly the loudest. Add to that the bristling of his sparse gray beard, and the flashing of his eyes through the thick lenses that served to magnify them almost frighteningly, and he was not to be ignored. "Ben Manfred is a self-made man," said Gonzalo defensively. "Maybe he is," said Reuben, reluctant to make any exceptions to any generalization he had launched. "But he self-made himself in the 1920s and 1930s. I'm talking about now, post-World War II America, which is prosperous and welfare-minded. You can always find help making your way through school, tiding yourself over unemployment, getting grants of some sort to help you get started. Sure, you can make it, but not by yourself. Never by yourself. There's a whole set of government apparatuses helping you." "Perhaps there is something in what you say, Manny," said Geoffrey Avalon, looking down with a somewhat distant amusement. His 74 inches made him the tallest of the Black Widowers. "Nevertheless, wouldn't you consider yourself a self-made man? I never heard that you inherited or married wealth, and I don't see you somehow accepting government handouts." "Well, I haven't gotten anything the easy way," said Reuben. "But you can't be a self-made man until you're made. If I didn't have a rich father, and don't have a rich wife, neither am I exactly rich myself. I can afford some of the niceties of life, but I'm not rich. What we have to do is define the self-made man. It's not enough that he's not starving. It's not enough that he's better off than he used to be. A self-made man is someone who starts off poor without any money above the subsistence level. Then, without getting large slabs of money from the outside, he manages through hard work and shrewd business acumen, or through enormous talent, to become a millionaire." "How about luck?" growled Thomas Trumbull. "Suppose someone enters a sweepstakes and wins $1 million, or suppose he consistently backs winners at a racetrack." Reuben said, "You know that doesn't count. You're just a luck-made man, then. That goes if you pull an old man from under a hackney coach and he calls down heaven's blessing on you and gives you $1 million. And I'm not counting those people who get rich by illegal activity. Al Capone, from a standing start, was making $60 million a year before he was 30, at a time when the dollar was worth a dollar and not 22 cents. He paid no taxes on it, either. You can call him self-made, but not by my definition." "The trouble with you, Manny," said Roger Halstead, "is that you want to restrict the term to people you approve of morally. Andrew Carnegie was a self-made man, and he was a great philanthropist after he had made his millions, and, as far as I know, he was never put in jail. Still, on his way up, I'll bet he engaged in questionable business activities, and that he managed to grind the faces of the poor when that was necessary." Reuben said, "Within the law is all I ask for. I don't expect people to be saints." Gonzalo said, with a totally unconvincing air of innocence, "What about your friend Isaac Asimov, Manny?" And, of course, Reuben rose to the bait at once. "My friend? Just because I lend him a few bucks now and then to help him pay the rent, money that I don't ever expect to see again, he goes around telling everyone he's my friend." "Come on, Manny. No one's going to believe that libel. He's well healed. And according to his autobiography, he started with nothing. He worked in his father's candy store, and he delivered newspapers, too. He's a self-made man. Is that so? Said Reuben. Well, if he's a self-made man, all I can say is that he certainly worships his creator. There was no telling how long Reuben would have gone on to improvise variations on this theme, but it was at this moment that Benjamin Manfred arrived, and conversation stopped at once while Gonzalo made the introductions. Manfred was of average height, quite thin, with a lined but good-natured face. His hair was sparse and white, his clothing neat and old-fashioned. He wore a vest, for instance, and one was surprised that the chain of a pocket watch was not looped from one side to the other. He wore a wristwatch instead, but it was so old-fashioned that it had a stem winder. He acknowledged the introductions with a pleasant smile, and when he shook hands with Reuben, said, "I'm so pleased to meet you, Mr. Reuben. I read your mysteries with such pleasure." "Thank you, sir," said Reuben, trying manfully to be modest. "In my stores I can always count on good sales for your books. You almost match Asimov." And he turned away to greet James Drake, while Reuben slowly turned a furious magenta, and the five other Black Widowers suffered substantial internal pain in their desperate efforts not to laugh. Henry, the perennial waiter of the Black Widowers, having seen to it that the old man was supplied with a generous dry martini, announced that dinner was served. Drake stubbed out his cigarette and looked at the small mound of caviar on his plate with pleasure. He helped himself to the condiments being passed around by Henry, hesitating at the chopped onion and then firmly taking two helpings. He whispered to Gonzalo, "How come you can afford caviar, Mario?" Mario whispered back, "Old man Manfred is paying me very nicely for a portrait he's sitting for. That's how I know him, and I might as well show him a bit of a good time with his money. It's nice to know people still want their portraits painted." "Some people still have good taste," said Gonzalo. Drake grinned. "Would you care to repeat that loudly enough for Manny to hear it?" "No, thanks," said Gonzalo. "I'm host, and I'm responsible for the decorum of the table." The table, as it happened, was perfectly decorous. Reuben seemed subdued and let pass a dozen opportunities to tell Manfred what was wrong with the book-selling business and how it contributed to the impoverishment of worthy young authors. If the Black Widowers were quieter for Reuben's withdrawal from the fray, they were happy enough and loud in their praise of the courses as they passed, the turtle soup, the roast goose with the potato pancakes and red cabbage, the baked Alaska, and perhaps just a trifle less than tactful in their clear surprise that a dinner hosted by Gonzalo should have such Lucullan overtones. Gonzalo bore it with good humor, and when it was time to tinkle the water glass melodiously with his spoon, he even made a noble attempt to mollify Reuben. He said, "Manny, you're the book person here, and as we all agree, the best in your class, bar none. Would you please do the honors in grilling Mr. Manfred?" Reuben snorted loudly and said with only his normal supply of grumpiness, "I might as well. I doubt that any of the rest of you are literate enough." He turned to Manfred and said, "Mr. Manfred, how do you justify your existence?" Manfred did not seem surprised at the question. He said, "If there's one person who shouldn't have trouble justifying his existence, it is someone whose business it is to purvey books. Books, gentlemen, hold within them the gathered wisdom of humanity, the collected knowledge of the world's thinkers, the amusement and excitement built up by the imaginations of brilliant people. Books contain humor, beauty, wit, emotion, thought, and indeed all of life. Life without books is empty." Halstead muttered, "These days there's movies and TV." Manfred heard. He said with a smile, "I watch television also. Sometimes I will see a movie. Just because I appreciate a meal such as the one we have just had doesn't mean that I may not eat a hot dog now and then. But I don't confuse the two. No matter how splendid movies and television may seem, they are junk food for the mind, amusement for the illiterate, a bit of diversion for those who are momentarily in the mood for nothing more." "Unfortunately," said Avalon, looking solemn, "Hollywood is where the money is." "Of course," said Manfred. "But what does that mean? Undoubtedly, a chain of hamburger joints will make more money than a 4-star restaurant, but that doesn't convert hamburger to Peking duck. Still, said Reuben, since we are discussing money, may I ask if you consider yourself a self-made man? Manfred's eyebrows lifted. That is rather an old-fashioned phrase, is it not? Right, said Reuben, with a stir of enthusiasm. I maintained exactly that over the cocktails. It is my opinion that nowadays it is impossible for anyone to be a truly self-made man. There is too much routine government help. Manfred shook with silent laughter. Before the New Deal, that was not so. The government in those days was a highly moral and neutral referee. If a large corporation had an argument with a small employee, the government's job was to see that both sides had only the help they could afford. What could be fairer than that? Of course, the rich always won, but that was just a coincidence, and if the poor man didn't see that, the government sent in the National Guard to explain things to him. Those were great days. Nevertheless, the point is that you were poor when you were young, were you not? Very poor. My parents arrived in the United States from Germany in 1907 and brought me with them. I was 3 at the time. My father was employed at a tailor's shop and made $5 a week to begin with. I was the only child then, but you can imagine how it improved his economic position when he later had 3 daughters, one after the other. He was a socialist and a vocal one, and as soon as he became a citizen, he voted for Eugene V. Debs. This made some people, whose views on freedom of speech were strictly limited to freedom of their speech, feel he ought to be deported. My mother helped out by part-time work in between babies. From the age of 9, I delivered papers in the morning before school and had odd jobs after school. Somehow, my father managed to accumulate enough money to make a down payment on a small tailor shop of his own, and I worked with him after school. Once I turned 16, I didn't have to stay in school anymore, so I quit at once to work in the shop full-time. I never finished high school. Reuben said, "You don't sound like an uneducated man." It depends on how you define education. If you are willing to allow the kind of education you pick up for yourself in books, then I'm educated, thanks to old Mr. Lineweaver. This Mr. Lineweaver gave you books? Only one, actually. But he got me interested in books. In fact, I owe nearly everything to him. I couldn't have gotten my start without him. So that maybe I'm not a self-made man. And yet, he didn't give me anything. I had to work it out for myself, so maybe I am a self-made man. You know, I'm honestly not sure. Drake said, "You've got me confused, Mr. Manfred. What was it you had to work out for yourself? A puzzle of some sort?" "In a way." "Is it a well-known episode in your life?" Manfred said, "There was some mention in newspapers at the time, but it was a long time ago and it has been forgotten. Sometimes, though, I wonder how fair the whole thing was. Did I take advantage? I was accused of undue influence and who knows what, but I won out." Reuben said, "I'm afraid, Mr. Manfred, I must ask you to tell us the story in detail. Whatever you say will be held completely confidential." Manfred said, "So Mr. Gonzalo told me, sir, and I accept that." But for a moment, Manfred's eyes rested on Henry, who stood with his usual air of respectful attention at the sideboard. Trumbull caught the glance and said, "Our waiter, whose name is Henry, is a member of the club." "In that case," said Manfred, "I will tell you the story. And if you find it dull, you have only yourselves to blame." "But wait," interjected Gonzalo eagerly. "If there's some kind of puzzle or mystery involved, I figure you solved it, right?" "Oh, yes. There is no mystery waiting to be solved." He waved his hands as though in erasure. "No puzzle." "In that case," said Gonzalo, "when you tell the story about Mr. Lineweaver, don't tell us the answer to the puzzle. Let us guess." Manfred chuckled. "You won't guess. Not correctly." "Good," said Reuben. "Please continue with the story, and we will try not to interrupt." Manfred said, "The story starts when I was not quite 15, just after the end of the war, the first one, World War I. It was Saturday, no school, but I still had papers to deliver, and the last stop on the route was an old mansion. I left the paper in a little hook on the side of the door, and once a week I rang the bell, and a servant came out and gave me the money for the papers, and would hand me a quarter as a tip. The general payment was a dime, so I was always grateful to this particular place. Saturday was collection day, so I rang the bell, and this time, for the first time I could remember, out came old Mr. Lineweaver himself. Maybe he just happened to be near the door when I rang the bell. He was about 70, and I thought he was just another servant. I had never seen him before. It was a bitterly cold day in January, 1919 it was, and I was inadequately dressed. I wore the only coat I had, and it was rather thin. My hands and face were blue, and I was shivering. I wasn't particularly sorry for myself, because I had delivered papers on many cold days, and that was the way it was, that's all. What could I do about it? Mr. Lineweaver was perturbed, however. He said, "Come inside, boy, I'll pay you where it's warm." His air of authority made me realize he was the owner of the house, and that scared me. Then, when he paid me, he gave me a dollar as a tip. I had never heard of a dollar tip. Next, he brought me into his library, a large room with bookshelves from floor to ceiling on every wall, and a balcony with additional books. He had a servant bring me hot cocoa, and he kept me there for almost an hour, asking me questions. I tried to be very polite, but I finally told him I had to go home or my parents would think I was run over. I couldn't call to reassure them, for in 1919 very few people had telephones. When I came home, my parents were very impressed, especially with the dollar tip which my father took and put away. It wasn't cruelty on his part. It was merely that there was a common coffer for the earnings of the entire family, and none of us could hold out any of it for themselves. My allowance for the week was exactly zero. The next Saturday, old Mr. Lineweaver was waiting for me. It wasn't nearly as cold as the week before, but he invited me in for hot cocoa again. When he offered me another dollar, I followed my father's instructions and told him that it was too much, and that a quarter would be enough. My father, I'm afraid, had learned from life to distrust unexplained generosity. Mr. Lineweaver laughed and said he had nothing smaller and that I must take it. I suspect he noticed the curious looks I was giving the books, for he asked if I had any books at home. I said my father had a couple, but they were in German. He asked if I went to school, and of course I said yes, but that as soon as I was 16 I would have to quit. He asked if I went to the public library, and I said that I did sometimes, but what with the newspaper delivery and the tailor shop, I didn't really have much chance to do so. "Would you like to look at these books?" he asked, waving his hands toward the walls. "I might get them dirty, Mr. Lineweaver," I said diffidently, looking at my hands, which were black with newspaper ink, of course. He said, "I tell you what. On Sundays, when you have no school and the tailor shop is closed, you come here after you've delivered your papers, and you can wash your hands and stay in the library as long as you want, and read some of those books. Would you like that?" "Oh, yes," I said. "Good," he said. "Then you tell your parents you'll be spending the time here." I did, and for 10 years I was there faithfully every Sunday, except when I was sick or he was away. Eventually, when I grew older, I came by on Saturday afternoons, and even on a few weekday evenings. He had a wonderfully wide variety of books for me to choose from, and was strong on British fiction. I read Thackeray and Trollope and puzzled over Tristram Shandy. I remember being fascinated by Warren's 10,000 a Year. It was a mixture of humor and incredibly reactionary politics. The anti-hero was Tittlebat Titmouse, and there was a very effective villain named Oily Gammon. I eventually learned from my reading that gammon was a slang term equivalent to our present slang term of baloney. I read Pope, Byron, Shelley, Keats, Tennyson, Coleridge. Didn't like Wordsworth or Browning for some reason. There was lots of Shakespeare, naturally. I wasn't strong on non-fiction, but I remember trying to read Darwin's Origin of Species and not getting very far. There was a new book, Outline of History, by H.G. Wells, that fascinated me. I read some American writers, too, Mark Twain and Hawthorne, but I couldn't stay with Moby Dick. I read some of Walter Scott. All this was spread out over years, to be sure. Trumbull, at this point, stirred in his seat and said, "Mr. Manfred, I take it this Lineweaver was a wealthy man." "Quite well-to-do, yes." "Did he have children?" "2 grown sons, a grown daughter."
"Grandchildren?"
"Several."
"Why did he make a surrogate son of you, then?"
Manfred considered.
"I don't know. The house was empty, except for servants. He was a widower. His children and grandchildren rarely came to visit. He was lonely, I suppose, and liked having a youngster in the house now and then. I'm under the impression he thought I was bright, and he certainly enjoyed my pleasure in the books. He would occasionally sit and talk to me about them, ask me what I thought of this book or that, and suggest new ones I might read. "Did he ever give you any money?" asked Trumbull. "Only that dollar a week, which he handed me without fail each Saturday. Eventually I dropped the paper route, but he didn't know that. I kept on delivering his paper every day. I'd buy it myself and deliver it." "Did he feed you?" "The hot cocoa. When I stayed through lunch, a servant would bring me a ham sandwich and milk, or the equivalent." "Did he give you books?" Manfred shook his head slowly. "Not while he was alive. Never. He wouldn't give me one or let me borrow one. I could read whatever I liked, but only as long as I sat in the library. I had to wash my hands before I walked into the library, and I had to put each book back on the shelf in the place where I had got it, before taking another." Avalon said, "I should think Mr. Lineweaver's children would resent you." "I think they did," said Manfred. "But I never saw them while the old man was alive. Once he said to me with a little chuckle, 'One of my sons said I must keep an eye on you, or you'll take some of my books.' I must have looked horrified at the insult to my parents. Would that be the kind of son they would bring up?" He laughed and tousled my hair and said, "I told him he didn't know what he was talking about." Reuben said, "Were his books valuable?" "At the time, it never occurred to me that they might be. I had no idea what books cost, or that some might be worth more than others. I found out eventually, though. He was proud of them, you see. He told me he had bought every one of them himself. I said that some of them looked so old he must have bought them when he was a little boy. He laughed and said, 'No, I bought many of them in second-hand bookstores. They were old when I got them, you see. If you do that, sometimes you can pick up some very valuable books for almost nothing.' 'Triple devil,' he said. 'Triple devil.' I thought he was referring to himself and how clever he was to find these valuable books. Of course, I didn't know which ones might be the valuable ones. As the years passed, I developed an ambition. What I wanted was to own a bookstore someday. I wanted to be surrounded by books and sell them till I had made enough money to build a library of my own, a collection of books I wouldn't have to sell and that I could read to my heart's content. I told this to Mr. Lineweaver once when he questioned me. I said I was going to work in the tailor shop and save every cent till I had enough to buy a bookstore, or maybe an empty store, and then buy the books." Lineweaver shook his head. "That will take a long time, Benny. The trouble is, I've got children of my own to take care of, even though they're a selfish lot. Still, there's no reason I can't help you out in some sneaky way that they won't be able to do anything about. Just remember, I own a very valuable book." I said, "I hope it's hidden away, Mr. Lineweaver." "In the best place in the world," he said. "Do you remember your Chesterton? What's the best place to hide a pebble?" I grinned. The Father Brown stories were new then, and I loved them. "On the beach," I said. "And the best place to hide a leaf is in a forest." "Exactly right," said Mr. Lineweaver. "And my book is hidden in my library." I looked about curiously. "Which one?" I asked, and was instantly sorry, for he might have thought I would want to take it. He shook his head. "I won't tell you. Triple devil. Triple devil." Again, I felt he was referring to his own slyness in not revealing his secret. In early 1929, 10 years almost to the day after I had first met him, he died, and I received a call from the lawyers to attend a reading of the will. That astonished me, but my mother was in seventh heaven. She felt I would inherit a great deal of money. My father frowned and worried that the money belonged to the family, and that I would be a thief to take it from them. He was that kind of person. I attended, dressed in my best clothes, and felt incredibly ill at ease and out of place. I was surrounded by the family, the children and grandchildren I had never before seen, and their looks at me were the reverse of loving. I think they too thought I would get a great deal of money. But they didn't have to worry. I was left one book, one from his library. Any book I wished. It was to be my free choice. I knew he wanted me to have the valuable one, but he had never told me which one that was. The bequest did not satisfy the family. You would think they could spare one book out of perhaps 10,000, but they apparently resented my even being mentioned in the will. The lawyer told me I could make my choice as soon as the will was probated. I asked if I might go into the library and study the books in order to make that choice. The lawyer seemed to think that was reasonable, but this was objected to at once by the family, who pointed out that the will said nothing about my going into the library. "You have been in the library often enough and long enough," said the older son. "Just make your choice, and you can have it when the will is probated." The lawyer wasn't exactly pleased by that, and he said that he would seal the library till probation, and no one could go in. That made me feel better, because I thought that perhaps the family knew which book was valuable and would remove it themselves. It took time for the will to be probated, so I refused to make the choice immediately. The family grumbled at that, but the lawyer held his ground there. I spent the time thinking. Had old Mr. Lineweaver ever said anything to me that was puzzling and that might have been intended as a hint? I could think of nothing but the triple devil he used to call himself when he wanted to praise his own slyness. But he only said that when he discussed the valuable book. Could the phrase refer to the book and not to himself? I was 24 now, and far from the innocent child I had been 10 years before. I had a vast miscellany of information at my fingertips, thanks to my reading, and when the time came for me to make my choice, I did not have to walk into the library. I named the book I wanted and explained exactly where it would be on the shelves, for I had read it, of course, though I had never dreamed it was valuable. The lawyer himself went in and got it for me, and it was the right book. As a book dealer, I now know why it was valuable, but never mind that. The point is that I had the lawyer, a good man, arranged to have it appraised, and then to have it sold at a public auction. It brought in $70,000, a true fortune in those days. If it were offered for sale now, it would bring in $250,000, but I needed the money then. The family was furious, of course, but there was nothing they could do. They brought suit, but the fact they had not let me enter the library and study the books lost them a great deal of sympathy. In any case, after the legal hassle was over, I bought a bookstore, made it pay through the Depression, when books were one form of relatively cheap amusement, and built things up to where they now are. So, am I a self-made man? Reuben said, "In my opinion, this doesn't come under the heading of luck. You had to pick one book out of 10,000 on the basis of a small and obscure hint, and you did. That's ingenuity, and therefore you earned the money. Just out of curiosity, what was the book?" "Hey," said Gonzalo angrily. Manfred said, "Mr. Gonzalo asked me not to give you the solution. He said you might want to work on it yourselves." The smoke from Drake's cigarette curled up toward the ceiling. He said in his softly hoarse voice, "One out of 10,000 on the basis of triple devil. We never saw the library, and you did. You knew what books were present, and we don't. It's scarcely a fair test." "I admit that," said Manfred. "So I'll tell you if you wish." "No," said Gonzalo. "We've got to have a chance. The book must have had devil in the title. It might have been The Devil and Daniel Webster, for instance." "That's a short story by Stephen Vincent Benet," said Manfred, "and wasn't published till 1937. Halstead said, "The usual image of the devil with horns, hooves, and a tail is drawn actually from the Greek nature god Pan. Was it a book about Pan, or with the word Pan in the title?" "Actually," said Manfred, "I can't think of one." Avalon said, "The witch goddess Hecate is often thought of as triple, maid, matron, and crone, because she was a moon goddess too, and those were the phases, first quarter, full, and last quarter. As a witch goddess, she might be looked at as a triple devil. Memoirs of Hecate County was published too late to be the solution, but is there something earlier with Hecate in the title?" "Not that I know of," said Manfred. There was a silence about the table, and Reuben said, "We just don't have enough information. I think the story was interesting in itself, and that Mr. Manfred can now tell us the solution." Gonzalo said, "Henry hasn't had his chance. Henry, have you any idea what the book might be?" Henry smiled. "I have a small notion." Manfred smiled too. "I don't think you will be correct." Henry said, "Perhaps not. In any case, people are often afraid to mention the devil by name, lest they call him up in the process. So they use numerous nicknames or euphemisms for him. Very frequently, they use the diminutive of some common masculine name as a kind of friendly gesture that might serve to placate him. Old Nick springs to mind." Manfred half rose from his seat, but Henry paid no attention. Once one thinks of that, it is simple to go on to think of Nicholas Nickleby, which, so to speak, is Old Nick twice, and is therefore Double Devil. "But we want Triple Devil, Henry," said Gonzalo. "The diminutive of Richard gives us Dickens, a very well-known euphemism for devil, as in What the Dickens? And the author of Nicholas Nickleby is, of course, Charles Dickens, and there is the Triple Devil. Am I right, Mr. Manfred?" Manfred said, "You're completely right, Henry. I'm afraid I wasn't as ingenious as I've thought these past 55 years. You did it in far less time than I did, and without even seeing the library." Henry said, "No, Mr. Manfred, I deserve far less credit than you. You see, you gave the solution away in your account of events." "When?" said Manfred, frowning. "I was careful not to say anything at all that would give you a hint." "Exactly, sir. You mentioned so many authors, and never once mentioned the outstanding English novelist of the 19th century, or probably any other century, or even, perhaps, any other language. Your failure to mention him made me think at once there was particular significance to the name Charles Dickens, and Triple Devil then had no mystery to me."